This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and as we begin this week's Big Picture, we are in that festive season of the year. It is the holiday season, and so we are going to be doing something special here on the program today. John is going to be reading from Charles Dickens' It's a Christmas Carol in Latin.
Here we go. Capitulum unum.
Oh, by the way, that means chapter one.
Marley mortuus erat ad primum.
Marley was dead to begin with.
Non est quo dubites.
There is no doubt whatever about that.
De sepultura registro per legem clericum.
The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the undertaker, and the chief mourner.
You know, Jim, I don't think this is going to work.
It was a good idea. Folks, it's a thought. It's the holidays, and we're just having a little fun here. For all of you that were altar boys, maybe you could follow along with us.
So funny. I have a book, Jim, that says, before we get on to our subject, because we need to talk about paradigms change. That's another thing I never understand. Why do we spell it that way? P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. That's a paradigm.
A paradigm.
Yeah, because you have more than one.
Or you're digging more than one.
Well, that seems to be what it is. Okay. Anyway, I do have a book that's Latin for all occasions. It has all sorts of great expressions when you want to look erudite. We're going to talk about, you remember the old song that came out in the 60s, and I think it was Buffalo Springfield, and the way the song went is, there's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. And of course, the refrain in that is always, it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Now, of course, that came out, Buffalo Springfield, 5 decades ago, and was part of the turmoil that was going on in the country back then. You can tell that right now, the world has been going through a paradigm shift. I'm not sure how many people recognize that that's what's happening right now, in which a lot of orders, narratives, and other financial situations are being overturned. And where we land, well, that remains to be seen. And frankly, Jim, it resembles very much what Strauss and Howe described in their book as the fourth turning. And they were calling for us to start the fourth turning, if you recall, right about now, plus or minus a couple of years. I think that's exactly what has just started in the West.
You know, John, this sort of began at the beginning of the new millennium with the election of George Bush. We had some major political changes. We had economic changes that continued with the election of Barack Obama. Because remember, just as Donald Trump talked about making America great again, he was the agent of change. That was the same thing that Barack Obama got elected in 2008. We went through the financial crisis, the bursting of, it was actually the second bear market in 7 years, and people were saying, we want change. And so Barack Obama came in, but then we got a bunch of changes that people weren't happy about, and mainly Obamacare. And we saw a change in Congress in 2010, where the Democrats lost control over the House. That continued in 2011, but this time on the global stage, with the Arab Spring, the pig crisis in the fall, and the debt ceiling debate, where there, you know, the U.S. debt got downgraded. It continued here in the U.S. with the elections of 2012 and 2014, when the Republicans gained control of both houses of Congress. And so there has been this dynamic change. And John, it is occurring all throughout the developed world and in parts of the undeveloped world, and especially seismic shifts that we've seen as a result of foreign policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, and what I should point out here, Jim, is that in this paradigm shift, there are several different components to it. The first component is economic. The second one is a political one. Of course, they go hand in hand. The third, however, is either a clash or a shift in religious or worldview values, and they're all running concomitantly with each other. Part of what we've seen, you know, the growth, if we look back over the last decade when we talk about economics, is in Europe, there's been stagnant economic growth, stagnation in Japan for several decades. They haven't gone anywhere. And despite $10 trillion of new debt and stimulus under the Obama administration, what's our GDP now? Right around 1%, the worst economic growth in a recovery since World War II.
Well, it is something. And here's one of the reasons why you're seeing such a backlash, and we're going to get into this, that you're seeing this in Europe, is since the formation of the euro, for example, Italian economic growth has been zip, zero. And we've seen it throughout the last decade, and we're seeing it now, where Europe has gone through more frequent recessions. You have seen wage stagnation. You have seen lower profit growth and productivity. You've seen overall a lower economic growth. And on top of that, a major releveraging, or Europe really leveraged up. Remember the argument that U.S. banks made to the SEC in 2004. They came back and said, look, we're only leveraged 12 to 1. How can we compete with our European counterparts that are leveraged 30 to 40 to 1? And John, that was the basis of the change in allowing banks to leverage up that came in 2004, because they're saying, hey, we want to be like Europe so we can compete and leverage up our balance sheets. Well, now, all that leveraging up of those balance sheets, and especially you can see this now with Italian banks, all of that leverage is coming home to roost in lower economic growth in Europe and lower economic growth here in the U.S. I mean, think about it. In one presidency, Barack Obama has added $10 trillion of debt. And we'll talk about this in part two of the big picture, how that is going to place limitations on the Trump administration, because U.S. debt will be $20 trillion when he assumes office in January. So a lot of this debt, a lot of these things are coming home to roost. But one of the main reasons a lot of people are upset, they're saying, and why you're seeing this anti-globalist movement, is factory jobs have been outsourced, whether it's to China, Asia, Mexico, an issue that Trump has been raising during his campaign and since he's become president-elect. And so there is a growing anti-immigration. There is a growing anti-globalist movement. And John, you remember, we saw this a couple of years ago with the Occupy Wall Street movement. You saw it in protest in Europe about globalism. You see this at the Davos get-togethers that they have every winter. So a lot of this is in response to the slow economic growth. And one of the things that we're going to be doing, and I highly recommend it, during the Christmas holidays, we're going to feature a book interview that I did with Mark Levinson. He's written a book called An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. And that will be coming up the last week of the year. I think it's the week, New Year's weekend, that we will be running that interview. And it plays into some of the themes that you're seeing here.
Yeah, what is interesting is how governments have become detached, and we're looking at Europe, UK, and the US, Canada, and stuff, have become detached from what a lot of the people are actually thinking. And the media, which have tended to echo, their echoing chambers for a lot of what's going on in government, failed to catch this as well. We saw that in the Brexit vote. It just startled everybody. Nobody really thought that's what was going to happen. Then here we had the Trump victory, and he won the Rust Belt, which lost and has yet to recover jobs. And as one person said, one left-wing commentator said the morning after the election, very soberly, people out there are hurting and we just didn't pick up on it. You know, we have become out of touch with what these people out in flyover land are actually undergoing. So this is the nature of it. You see this in Europe and some of the reaction to unlimited immigration and the problems that it's been causing. It's the same phenomenon everywhere, whether it's an economic one or whether it's a sociological one.
Well, it's amazing, too, because the U.S. has lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. And, John, manufacturing has spillover effects. It's not just a manufacturer. If somebody sets up a factory, you're talking about ancillary-type investments that are associated with that factory, people that bring raw materials, that bring parts, businesses that grow around that. And that's what's happened. We've hollowed out. I mean, it's hard to believe. At one time, the U.S. economy was almost 25% manufacturing. Now it's primarily consumption in service. And so a lot of these jobs have left. And what Trump is doing, and of course, everybody's seen the carrier deal. Now it's Boeing. And he's basically saying to these corporations, look, we know why you're leaving. John, any idea what was the number one complaint about businesses to Trump? Any idea what that was?
Oh, I know what this one is. You going to pay me $1,000?
No.
Well, I'm not going to answer it. No. In reality, the one thing they're all complaining about is regulation and taxes. Those are the two things that the medium to small businesses are all complaining about. That is their obstacle to survival.
Absolutely right. At the top of the list, everybody would have thought taxes because U.S. tax rates are the highest in the world. Corporate tax rates are 35%. And it's one reason why you have trillions of dollars parked overseas that don't come back here, because they're saying, why are we going to bring them back here? We're going to pay 35% tax. Plus, if you know you're a California corporation, you're going to pay 13.3% tax. So why would anybody want to do that? So Trump is saying, look, we're going to get rid of these regulations. For every one regulation that's put in place, two are going to be sunsetted, or we're going to get rid of them so that you can operate unrestrained. It's one reason why we've never had shovel-ready projects, beginning with Obama's stimulus program, because, John, there is a just endless maze a bureaucratic red tape to get anything done. I know here in San Diego, it took us 10 years to get one freeway put in from the I-15 to the I-5 because of environmental and bureaucratic regulations. And so a lot of companies are saying, look, get rid of these regulations. And then, of course, you know, lower the tax rate. So Trump is basically saying to these companies, look, if I get rid of the regulations and I get rid of tax rates or bring them down to a more reasonable level, then we want you to stay here and invest. If you still insist on moving to another country or your factory someplace else, there are going to be consequences of that. And John, that is a major paradigm shift that is resonating throughout the country, but it's not resonating with what I call the government media and the power elites that run the country out of Washington. And I think that's what this election surprise was all about. And folks, there's more surprises coming down the road.
The other area, by the way, of regulation that people don't seem to understand is that the compliance cost of regulation. And I know one of your clients formerly had a dairy, and I had a conversation with him at one point, and he was saying, you have no idea what it's like trying to run a business when all you're doing all day long is jumping through hoops that don't necessarily achieve anything. But, and he said, these environmental agencies, and his dairy was in California, he said, we're dealing with the feds, we're dealing with the state, we're dealing with the county. We can't get our jobs done. Plus, we're required to do things that just require thousands and thousands of dollars, as I said, for questionable amounts of money. So, but you know, this is a change. You're seeing this reaction to this, which is sort of normal. That's what Strauss and Howe said, wasn't it? Every you go through four turnings in any saeculum, and then the fourth turning is one of reform. And he said they either successfully reform or they deteriorate into chaos, at which point usually freedom goes with it because some kind of strongman is required to hold it together. But you do see this trend. There's the Brexit that really took everybody by surprise. The reaction since last, remember, it was New Year's in Cologne when they had that incredible series of assaults that went on largely by immigrants in Germany on people who were celebrating on New Year's Eve in Cologne. And of course, that began to rip around. And you're seeing the effects of that. Trump's victory here, the Brexit vote, what's going on in Europe, the Italian elections this last week. And you know, there's going to be a referendum vote coming in the very near future on whether or not Italy's going to stay inside the European Union. And François Hollande, the president of France, said he's not going to run again. If you notice, they're dropping like flies, so to speak. And finally, Angela Merkel, and this is a European issue, has called for a ban on the burqa, which I think is going to be too little, too late. I'm not even sure that would actually accomplish anything. I'm beginning to call her Angela Merkel, you know, so even though I tend to like her, Jim. But these are the changes we're seeing, you know.
Well, it's accelerating. In fact, there was a article in the Wall Street Journal talking about this very thing that we saw this week with the vote coming in left. And the title of the article was called Europe's Left Loses Further Ground with Matteo Renzi's Resignation. And they were talking about of Europe's five largest economies, the left only governs two now, France in Italy. And they talked about Francois Hollande. He said he's not going to seek election. They also talked about how the center-left agenda is failing. And they're talking about a five-star movement within Italy. They're talking about conservative backlash and a move to the right in Spain. Possibly Germany and Poland, center-right parties are gathering. And even though in Austria, the center-right candidate lost, the Freedom Party remains the strongest political force despite its candidate's loss to a left on an independent. And then they talk about one of the restrictions that has happened with Euro. And there, we've had a lot of guests here on the program that are predicting the demise of the Europe. And I think you're going to see that. It may begin with Italy. And who knows, Spain may be next. Greece may be next. So this is something that is not stopping with Brexit. It's not stopping with Italy's vote. I think Italy's next. So there are far sweeping paradigm shifts that are occurring here, and especially now with the election of President-elect Donald Trump.
Last week, we talked about some of the effects that we thought a Trump presidency would be and how it would contrast against, probably against that of Barack Obama and also of George Bush. In other words, Barack Obama and George Bush started out in very similar circumstances. For Mr. Trump, it's noticeably different.
Well, I mean, there are a number of things. First and foremost, Trump will cause a shift in U.S. growth, although I would dispute some of the economic numbers that they're talking about, 3.5% and 4.5% growth. There's going to be a shift in growth. There's going to be a shift in inflation and interest rate expectations. Remember, we've spent 8 years with interest rates declining to the bottom of this summer when 10-year treasuries got down to 1.3%. And, you know, if you had a 3-month T-bill, you had a negative rate of return, meaning you paid the government to loan them money. And we saw that globally in Europe and Japan where yields went negatively. So as inflationary expectations increase, you're going to see monetary policy tighten and growth and inflation accelerate. And I think this trend is just getting started. And so just as we saw a trend with Obama that lasted throughout his presidency, I think you're going to see this last throughout Trump's presidency. And if it works, it may be a second term. But it's going to be supporting growth and creating jobs. However, the real question is, will Keynesian demand management mark the end of a 35-year bull market in bonds that goes back to 1981? And that culminated, as we have talked about all year long, the lowest interest rates recorded in financial history. And so could we see a normalization that takes place over Trump's term where we start to see, let's say, the federal funds rate get back to maybe 3%, 4%, or 5%? And what's going to be the implication of a $20 trillion U.S. debt? Because for every 1 percentage point increase in interest rates, the government spends $200 billion more in interest. One of the great things that Obama was fortunate to be president under is he doubled the national debt by $10 trillion, and yet interest expense for the U.S. government actually fell throughout his presidency as we were adding more debt. I mean, the government spent less money on interest in 2016 than it did in 2008. I think that's going to be one of the first trends that are going to reverse itself here.
You know, I was thinking when you were talking there, Jim, I remember when you talked to Lionel Shriver about her book, The Mandibles, you know, in which he has this scenario of 2029 and the dollar collapses, the economy collapses. One of the things she brought up in the interview, are we ever going to be really serious about paying off this debt? Because it may come to the point where you just can't. So that means at some point you're going to have to renege upon it.
Well, there's two things that happen. One of the problems is with financial repression, you want to grow inflation faster than your debt. Unfortunately, with low economic growth and the worst in World War II since World War II, the debt in the U.S. was growing faster than economic growth rates. So that's why you always want inflation growing much faster, because it really, you inflate the debt away, is another way of looking at it. Because I think one of the things that you're seeing since Trump became president-elect, you're seeing the rise in interest rates. And interest rates have risen considerably since that time. In fact, I'm just going to go here to a Bloomberg screen on interest rates and give you an idea of the dramatic change that we've seen, not just here in the U.S. I mean, it's hard to believe, folks, prior to Election Eve, November 8th, rates had risen from 1.3 to 1.8. On the day we're doing this interview, the 10-year Treasury note is at 2.35. We're also seeing, if you look at other interest rates in Treasuries, three-month Treasury bills are over 0.5%, anticipating the Fed's rate hike, which will probably take place next week. You've seen 30-year Treasury bonds actually go over 3%. And a lot of the negative interest rates that we've seen overseas, whether it's in Europe and Japan, have become less negative and in some cases have actually gone positive. So one of the second things that you're going to see is rising U.S. bond yields are going to result in higher bond yields all over the world. And that's one thing that has happened. It originated here on November 9th, the day after the election. And John, this is jumped across the pond. You're seeing it in Europe. You're seeing it in Asia. UK bond yields, which were down to 0.5% this summer, are now almost 1.25%. You're seeing Japanese bond yields, which were negative, are now positive, not by much, 4 basis points. Spanish bond yields are at 1.5%. So you're seeing this, not this transformation in interest rates rise globally, and there's a question, how long will the ECB and the Bank of Japan be able to maintain lower interest rates? And then I think the third trend that you're going to see as a result of, number one, faster economic growth in the U.S., higher inflation rate in the U.S., and higher interest rates, the dollar could strengthen further, contrary to a lot of individuals that thought the dollar bull market ended in 2015. There is enormous spread widening that's taking place if you take a look at interest rates. And as I mentioned, I mean, if you look at 10-year notes here in the U.S., 2.35. If you look at a 10-year note in Germany, it's 0.35. If you look at a 10-year note in Japan, it's 4 basis points. If you look at Spain, 1.4. So you have a faster growing economy, higher inflation and higher interest rates. So the spread between the U.S. and the rest of the world. So you have two factors that are going to be positive on the dollar. Rising interest rates that are much higher. I mean, interest rates here are higher by 2 full percentage points than they are in Germany, Europe's best growing economy. And you could see a short squeeze in the emerging market, which would further exacerbate the rise in the dollar. So this dollar trend should continue.
Yeah, but if this dollar trend continues, you know, all of these developed countries that have borrowed in dollars, this is not good news for them.
No. In fact, emerging markets are going to be the obvious victim of a rampant dollar. And you could even see China itself get into trouble in terms of, you know, with protectionism and a dollar squeeze. And that could really bring about trouble in emerging markets. Also, the Eurozone is threatened by Trump's election even more obviously than the EM countries, because you're seeing this take place with the elections this week in Italy. You're seeing disruption in other countries, whether it's Spain, the periphery countries. And that, I think, is going to be one of the fallouts that you're going to see further fallouts develop in Europe. And just imagine what happens if the Europe starts to come apart, or as a result, the bond market rebels against Europe as they did in 2011 with the pig crisis. So there are a lot of bigger picture implications of all of this.
Now let's talk about the implications in the stock market, because the Dow is at records, S&P at records, and NASDAQ at records too. So the market seemed to like this.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of money. You got to remember, prior to the election, because it was going back and forth. Hillary Clinton was moving in the polls, and that one time Trump coming out of the Republican convention, he was moving up. And then we had the FBI, all those kind of things that was going back and forth. So there were a lot of people that were sitting on the sidelines and holding off with their bets based on the outcome of the election. I think a lot of that is, I think the markets have gotten ahead where they think this is going, because even if Trump was to get everything he wanted, as we have talked about in the past, it's going to take time to get these things ready. So I think the growth, the inflation, all the things that the market is reacting to now is a second half story for 2017, John, because you and I have followed politics long enough. We know it takes time before either monetary policies get impacted or you see stimulus spending take place. And the stimulus spending take place, there was an article in Barron's this week about, they call it BAB or Build America Bonds, where Trump, rather than trying to escalate the deficit, because he knows he's inheriting $20 trillion of debt, he cannot do what Obama did in 2009 and increase the deficit by trillions of dollars each year. And we go back to 1.5, or I think the largest deficit under Obama was 1.4 trillion. He can't do that. The markets will not let him get away with that. So he's going to have to figure a more creative way to get around and finance these deficits. But it is going to bring a change in allocation. And I predict you're going to see money start to move gradually out of bond funds, and we're going to see the great rotation into stocks, where stocks are going to become the new bonds.
Okay, so what we're not saying here is that there's an imminent crash or move out of the market. All we're saying, I'm assuming, is that there's going to be a different type of market.
Oh, absolutely, because if you are going with a reflation trade and assuming that inflation begins to climb, interest rates begin to climb, obviously, with sizable tax cuts, increased infrastructure and defense spending, protectionism, and a stronger stance on immigration, all of these, John, are inherently inflationary policies. So the real question is, what will happen at the Fed? Because if Trump lowers taxes, creates economic stimulus through fiscal spending, but the Fed gets aggressive and raises interest rates, they will basically nullify everything Trump's doing. And in this case, with $20 trillion of debt that he inherits, that would squash it. And there's already talk on Trump's economic team. He's talking about appointing a new Fed regional governor and a new Fed chairman when Yellen's term ends, I think it's 2018. Her term comes to an end, and he would probably appoint. And also, you got to remember, the Fed has got to tread lightly here. If all of a sudden they withheld raising interest rates for 7 years and only raised them twice in a 2-year period, and all of a sudden Trump gets elected and they get really aggressive and start raising interest rates, there's going to be a political backlash to that.
Yeah, and remember we had this move, actually was spearheaded, I think, by Congressman Ron Paul, who's no longer in Congress, about auditing the Fed, saying that they're sort of unaccountable to anybody in what they're doing, and we don't really quite always know what they're doing. But I always maintain that I think the Fed chairman has more power than the president of the United States, you know, and anything, like you say, anything that, say, President Trump does when he's in office can be offset by something that the Fed does.
Yeah, it was amazing. There was a quote once of Bill Clinton, and he was at some, I guess, political event at the White House, and a reporter came up and said, "How does it feel to be the most powerful man in the world?" And he said, "I'm the second most powerful man. The most powerful man is right over there." And he pointed to Alan Greenspan. And of course, you remember the Time magazine article, "The Committee to Save the World," which had Greenspan, Summers, and Rubin. So the real question here is, what's going to happen at the Fed? And the Fed has already given us an indication that they will likely not rush abruptly to tighten monetary policy. If you look at the dot plots, the way they stand right now, the Fed is anticipating maybe only 2 rate hikes coming next year, which would put us roughly at about 1.25. Because, I mean, remember this year, we started out with markets predicting 4 rate hikes looks like we're only going to get one. So there's a lot of things that are going on here, and you would see a backlash in the political field of all of a sudden for keeping interest rates as low as they have, and then to get very aggressive on raising interest rates as a result of the unemployment rate. And John, we know the unemployment rate, which fell to 4.6%, was mainly due to the participation rate. 500,000 workers dropped out of the job force. That's not a way to get lower unemployment. I mean, theoretically, if enough people stop looking for unemployment, you could get it down, the unemployment rate down to 1 or 2%. I mean, there's 94 million teenage youth, 16 and older, that are out of work right now. So the problem that is going to constrain some of this is the global environment remains marked by a deficient demand and is still in a disinflationary trend, even though what might happen here may go in the reverse direction.
If you talk about inflation, gold always does well, but actually, let me see, gold has what? It's fallen since Trump's election. It's usually a panic metal, let's put it that way. In other words, if people think things are going to go south economically. So what do you do then? In what are we in, a reflationary type of environment?
Well, in a reflationary environment, you would see gold go up. I mean, that's exactly what it did in the last decade, where you had Greenspan raising interest rates in 2004. So you had rising interest rates and rising gold prices. Initially, the dollar fell after the election, because since the election, the dollar is up about 4.5%. So they are reversely correlated. But typically, in a reflationary environment, you see healthcare would generally do well in inflationary periods. There's a number of reasons. There are drivers behind that: an aging population, emerging markets are adopting healthcare safety nets, and pricing power is expanding in the healthcare sector. Consumer staples always do well because they have the ability with brands to raise prices. Consumer discretionary would do well. Real estate would do well, which, you know, Trump's net worth is in real estate, and real estate benefits with inflation. Energy is doing well. One of the best performers next to gold this year would do well. And financials typically would do well with a steepening yield curve, because the banks pay you less on your deposit, but they're going to charge you more on loans. And then the other thing that's going to be doing well is capital equipment, industrials, and materials. So there is going to be a major paradigm shift here in the markets, given the fact that, assuming that these policies are enacted within the first 100 days, because, John, we know that whatever, anytime anything gets done in Congress, you have two political parties, you have special interest groups, and they're not going to just sit there lay down and say, okay, you guys can have your way. They're going to try to influence the process. It's like a sausage making process, and it's going to take time. But the one thing that Trump has going for him is he's got both houses of Congress. The Republicans have been sitting on a tax plan for almost 8 years under Obama. So they've got that ready to go. There will probably be some ironing out of differences. Trump can get the Democrats to go along on infrastructure spending. There's probably going to be some negotiating on spending in terms of defense. But these things are going to go and be enacted probably in the first half. And we'll talk about, in the second part of the big picture, the economy that Trump inherits, because there's been a lot of stories out in the government media that Trump is inheriting the strongest economy of any president. In other words, President Barack Obama is handing off to Trump a strong American economy, and we disagree with that assumption, which will be the topic, just the facts, in the next part of the big picture. But John, this is a major paradigm change, and just as you shifted your portfolios coming out of the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, it was amazing, because everybody throughout that period were expecting to see another major crash when the crash already happened. The stock market went up over 2%. Interest rates fell down to the lowest levels in history. There were paradigm shifts in the market. Those paradigm shifts are coming once again, not just here in the United States. They're coming globally.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Matthew Kirchhoff, contributor to Dow Theory Letters and also the chief investment strategist at Model Investing, joins us today. And Matt, I want to ask you about a conversation we just had with Neil Dutt at Renaissance Macro. He's the head of economics there. And basically, his outlook is fairly positive when we think about the U.S. economy. We talked about the fact that the November print for unemployment is at 4.6%. It's at a 9-year low. So at least when we look at the official numbers, unemployment is low. We are at or near full employment. But with that being said, you know, one of the things that he said at the very end of that interview was how he thought there was actually a risk coming out of Washington if we see too much stimulus from the Trump administration. And, you know, particularly when we look at this $1 trillion infrastructure program that Donald Trump is proposing. And the reason for that is, I guess, because if we pump in all of this fiscal stimulus while we're at a 9-year low in unemployment, you know, there's some risks in terms of getting perhaps too much of a boom and inflationary risks and how that's going to translate to monetary policy and whether or not the Fed may be forced to raise interest rates quicker than expected if we see a lot of inflationary pressures building. So I want to get your thoughts on this because I do know that you wrote a recent note on sort of the boom and bust cycles that we see over time. How does that play into your view in terms of the need for creating thousands of new jobs, as Trump says, and this $1 trillion infrastructure program?
Well, first, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks for having me back. You know, I tend to agree with your guest's views on what's going on with the employment situation and the labor market at the moment. Her president-elect really ran on this campaign promise of creating an abundance of new jobs. But what's interesting is if you look at the data, our economy has been creating quite a few jobs. In fact, we've been creating above-trend numbers of jobs for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And so with the unemployment rate down to 4.6%, by most economists' definitions, that actually is full employment. And so at this point, if we do continue creating jobs, to your other guest's point, that does have the potential to create some negative feedback in the system. And so basically what we see is that around a 4.5 to 5% unemployment rate, demand and inflationary pressures within the economy tend to be roughly balanced. And obviously there's a range in which that occurs. But as you push unemployment lower and lower, what you actually start to see is the labor market truly heats up. We start to see rising wages. That often translates into higher inflation levels and therefore higher interest rates. In effect, kind of what we've been seeing lately. And as higher interest rates come onto the market, it's going to sort of redirect the flow of capital. We've seen bonds sell off quite a bit. And even though the market has been rallying as rates have risen recently, ultimately higher and higher rates are going to put a little bit of a limit on the appreciation of stocks as well.
So welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the second part of the big picture today. Well, in January 20th, President-elect Trump will take over, and the media have gone out of their way to promote where they believe President Obama has left us. I don't know if you watched, CNN was doing a thing on the legacy of Barack Obama, which was pretty much of a glow piece, as I call it, ignoring facts which might have, you know, taken a little polish off of the glow, so to speak. But they're telling us that he is leaving office, leaving behind a strong economy, low inflation, low unemployment. What is really interesting is that we're getting this little blip in the economic numbers that we normally do in the third quarter. But the pattern over the last few years, we've talked about it a lot here on the show, so this is nothing new, is a strong second and third quarter. And then the economy weakens in the fourth quarter and into the first quarter. And it used to be that the Fed would try to do a little goose to try to get it going again in the first, though that pattern is somewhat altered. But the question is this really a strong, wonderful, robust economy? What are the numbers really saying compared to what it is the media are really saying?
Well, you know, as we covered in the Trumpian revolution last week, John, there are a number of issues that every president faces when he steps into the Oval Office. And one of the things that I think that you hardly hear any mention of it, occasionally it will come out in the press, but you did not hear it from either Trump himself, Hillary Clinton, during the political campaign, and quite honestly, you didn't hear it from much of the media, and that is the national debt. Now, we're doing this interview, this part of the big picture, on a Thursday. And as of this Thursday, December 8th, 2016, the national debt is $19,948 billion, and it will be over $20 trillion when Donald Trump moves into the Oval Office January 20th. So this is going to limit any kind of president, because it's hard to believe, if you think back to the year 2000, the national debt was only $5 trillion. Bush doubled it, Obama doubled it, and what is even more significant, the amount of debt that Obama added to the national debt was more than his 43 predecessors combined in their entirety. And so, you know, one of the big questions is, President-elect Trump is talking about increasing defense spending. He's talking about doing infrastructure spending. He's talking about doing a massive fiscal stimulus to the program. And everybody's for it. Everybody says, hey, we need to make the economy grow faster. But this national debt is going to place a limitation in terms of the president's ability to act, because he's already starting office with a massive credit card bill that he's going to have to deal with, not to mention any new spending that he wants to push through Congress on any of his agenda programs.
And we've pointed this out before, that one of the issues that Mr. Trump's going to be facing is that both when President George Bush, W. Bush, came to office and President Obama came in, the Fed was in the process of lowering rates. But here we go. The Fed's going to meet again next week, and it's anticipated that they're going to be raising rates. So this is a reversal of the conditions that were met by the previous two presidents when they assumed office.
Yeah, and it's not just that, John. If you take a look at the Treasury report, every month the U.S. Treasury reports what the interest rate is overall on all of the outstanding U.S. debt. And if you just look at November 2016 versus November 2015, the interest rate on all of what I call public debt was 2.02 last year at this time. This year, the interest rate on public debt has dropped below 2%. It's 1.96% average on all the debt. Now, the government also has what is called non-marketable debt. This is money that's held by the Social Security Trust Fund. Last year, it was at 3.02. This year, it's at 2.76. Overall, when you take non-marketable debt and marketable debt, the interest rate on the national debt has gone from 2.32 last November to 2.2 this November. So, in other words, interest rates have dropped 0.1%. Now, here's an interesting fact. When Obama took office January 20th, 2009, the 10-year note had a yield of 2.4%. Fast forward to where we are today on this week, and guess where the 10-year Treasury note is, John?
Well, this one's a no-brainer. It's pretty much the same as they were at the very same time that President Obama came into office.
Exactly. He assumed office January 20th, 2009. The interest rate was 2.40. Fast forward almost 8 years later, and the day we're doing this broadcast, the interest rate on the 10-year Treasury note, John, is 2.41.
But I thought, Jim, you know, overall, what, 8 years, interest rates have been trending down.
Well, that was true, because this summer, we actually got down to 1.32 intraday, closing at 1.37, and that was July of 2016. However, throughout this trend, and you got to remember, and this is interesting because I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen. It's hard to believe, if we would have looked at interest rates on 10-year notes back in July this past summer, The interest rate on treasuries was 1.37. You had the interest rate on German 10-year bonds. It was negative. Interest rates on Japanese bonds were negative. If we take a look at where we are now, we've gone from 1.37 to 2.41. German interest rates have gone to 4 basis points from a negative 20 basis points. Japanese bond yields have actually gone positive. So the rise in interest rates here have rippled across the globe. But basically, President Obama is about to leave office with the same interest rate on treasuries when he entered the Oval Office. But the good thing about this, for the government, Obama has added $10 trillion to the national debt. But during that time, as a result of a drop in interest rates, the annual interest expense, and the government breaks it up in two parts, the interest expense that they report in their financial statements on debt held by the public, and then the interest rate that is held in Social Security trust funds and foreigners. And in 2008, the government spent overall $450 billion in interest expense. And as of September 2016, the government is spending a little over $400 billion. So in other words, John, in that period of time, we've added $9 trillion more in national debt, a little over $9 trillion in national debt, and the government interest expense has fallen by $50 billion.
This came up on the show last week, but during the time of President Obama's presidency, we have seen the lowest interest rates in recorded financial history. And for 7 years of that administration, the Fed kept rates at 0%. This is not going to be the situation when President Trump comes in. It's the reverse of that. He'll face rising rates and now a massive debt. Remember, it pretty well doubled under George W. and now it has doubled again under Mr. Obama. And as the rates rise, the servicing of that debt takes more and more of our budget.
Yeah, it's rather interesting because as Trump heads into the White House, the thing that he's going to be facing is a Federal Reserve that is in a rate-raising mode, as it's widely expected next week. The Fed will raise interest rates a quarter of a point. What is going to be interesting to see, because there will be a press conference, in terms of what Janet Yellen says about rates going forward into 2017. Now, last year, when they raised rates in December, the Fed was very optimistic on economic growth. They were talking about, you know, raising rates 4 times. We saw how quickly that changed in February when the markets went down 6 weeks in a row. So I don't think anybody really knows how the market's going to react, although it's already baked into 3-month treasury bills because 3-month T-bills now are over 0.5%. So the T-bill market is already anticipating a quarter point hike. What's interesting, though, as I mentioned, the overall interest rate on the national debt is 2.2%. And here's an interesting fact. For every 1 percentage point that the interest rates go up on interest paid on the debt, that adds an additional $200 billion to that $400 billion of annual interest expense. Now, they're talking about the Fed eventually normalizing interest rates, getting them into the 3 to 4% range. Well, John, if they take the federal funds rate to 3%, 4%, whatever the number is, let's just say they take it to 3%. That's another 2% hike from where we are today, a little bit more than 2%. That could add $400 billion of annual interest expense. And unlike the past, there is a greater percentage ownership of U.S. debt by foreigners than there was in the past. So if we take a look at who owns the outstanding public debt, that's $12.9 trillion. 65% of that debt is owned by the U.S., which is a good thing. However, China owns 7% of our debt, or roughly $1.3 trillion. Japan owns 6% of our debt at $1.1 trillion, and other foreign countries, including OPEC, own $3.8 trillion of our debt. So basically, foreigners now own 35% of our marketable debt, and that does place somewhat of a restriction and limitation on any administration entering into office. The net change is our national debt at close to 20 trillion now. We're only, what, 42 billion away from 20 trillion, is now greater than 100% of GDP. And the two things that the president-elect is going to be facing is a rising interest rate environment, which is unlike his predecessors, and it's going to handicap and make it less flexible. In other words, if the national debt was only $5 trillion and you had a $19 trillion economy, it would give the president a lot more leeway to do kind of things of spending money to stimulate the economy. It's going to make it a lot tougher when you're talking about massive spending, when you already have a $20 trillion economy and you have interest rates rising and the Fed in a rate-raising mode.
Yeah, this comes down to the subject of election promises, which we have discussed at random here. This is going to handicap President Trump's flexibility to carry out those programs that he wants. And what's interesting, by the way, is whenever this type of thing, whether a president's plans are carried out or not, or how well he's doing, or the economy, if you've ever noticed, interest rates are very, very rarely discussed. The Fed's policy doesn't seem to enter the conversation.
No, it's just like, well, he wants to do this. Everybody agrees we need to repair our roads, bridges, and dams, our highway system. There's no disagreement there. There's a strong growing call for fixing the defense budget and increasing defense spending. So there's a lot of agreement on that among the Republicans. But they're not talking about this $20 trillion in debt or the fact that the Federal Reserve is now raising interest rates. So it is going to limit this president's some of the flexibility and what he's able to carry out.
Interest rate and debt are two things. Then we always hear discussed, there's going to be a big debate over Obamacare. Even as they debate that, people are ignoring the idea that Medicare is in trouble. We have a huge amount of entitlements. You know, baby boomers now are retiring in large numbers. They have paid into Social Security all their lives, just as the fund is running into trouble. And basically, entitlement spending locks in at least 70% of the budget. I mean, we can only tinker with about 30%. So, you know, unless you just simply say you're going to start reneging on all of these commitments to people that you've made promises to pay.
Well, this is interesting, and this is something we included in our forecast seminar recently. Medicare, Social Security, and interest on the debt is 68% of the government's budget. So really what you're talking about, John, I don't care, you know, to run defense and the rest of government, you're only talking about roughly 30% of the government's budget. So you want to run everything else. You don't have a lot of money that you can move from one department or one program to another. I mean, one of the ways they staved off bankruptcy of the Social Security Disability Fund is they increased Medicare premiums on individuals. We'll talk more about that when it comes to Medicare. And they changed and made Social Security less favorable for women by getting rid of file and suspend and other maneuvers that were put into place to correct some of the discrepancy between income between men and women. And all that did, John, was buy them 1 year's worth of time. Basically, they got them through the election. So you've only got 30% of the government's budget that is free to take care of defense and the other things they want to do. And the other issue is they want to increase spending. And the defense budget is broken up into two parts: equipment, weapon systems, things of that nature, ammo, all the kind of stuff that you need to fight a war or defend yourself. And then there's what we call the personnel expense. That's what it costs to pay your sailors, your Air Force people, your Army people, and pensions and things of that nature. Non-personal defense spending is the lowest it's been since the end of the Vietnam War. And so that's why, you know, I've often commented here, because San Diego is a big military city. We've got four carrier battle groups out of 10 are based in San Diego. We have a sub base. We have the largest Navy SEAL base. We have the largest Marine training at Camp Pendleton. So we have a lot of military activity that goes on in this town. And the news is always talking about every time the carrier battle groups come in town, they're scrambling for parts. So we want to increase government spending for defense, and it's going to take a lot of money to correct to put in the weapon systems, to update our ships. One of the things that I go sailing with a lot of guys in the Navy, and they're telling me that the age of the ships is also going up. They usually like to keep them around 10 to 12 years and upgrade the fleet so you've got modern ships, modern weapon systems. We just came out with a new battleship that has got cost overruns, and we need to upgrade our fleet. So there's a lot of request for spending money, whether it is upgrading our infrastructure or it's upgrading our defense system, John. And the problem is, to do all that stuff, you're only dealing with about 30% of what the government takes in their budget, because the rest of it is spoken for by Medicare, Social Security, and the interest on the debt. So it is going to place some limitation, or it's going to take some creative financing. It has been suggested, and we may see this, just as we had savings bonds. It was the war bonds. Remember in World War II, they got the public to finance war bonds to help finance the war. And there's talk about Build America bonds, bringing those back and financing them at 50-year and 100-year maturities. In other words, when I mentioned that the interest on the debt outstanding is only 2.2%, a lot of people are suggesting if you are smart and you understand debt, and certainly Trump does, being in real estate, because real estate is financed with debt, it would be smart to lock in interest rates at the lowest they've ever been in recorded history for a 50 to 100-year period. And President-elect Trump has mentioned he's looking at private participation in this infrastructure program. So we may see a new government program come out that doesn't add to the deficit, called Build America Bonds. But it is an issue, John, that this president-elect is going to face, because he wants to do a lot of things, but he's only dealing with about 30% of the government's budget in a rising interest rate environment.
So to reiterate here, then, Trump is facing a Fed which is in tightening mode. And the real question is, if they continue to do this tightening, what happens to interest rates going forward? Will it offset anything else Mr. Trump is trying to do economically?
That's going to be one of the big questions that investors are going to be facing next year, along with the administration, because throughout the entire Obama presidency, we've seen nothing but falling interest rates, and we had zero interest rates at the Fed for almost 7 years. That is unprecedented. I mean, Greenspan brought rates down in 2001, and he kept them there for 3 years and began raising them at every Fed meeting, every single meeting beginning in 2004. Well, the Fed kept interest rates at zero. They raised them once last year, and they're raising them once this year. And there's a question, should the economy start to hobble? Now, I'm going to give you a couple of reasons why we think that could happen, because you have two things that are going on right now. As a result of anticipation of fiscal spending, you've seen a rise in interest rates in the government bond market. You have also seen a rise in the dollar. A rise in the dollar hurts multinational corporations that make up the S&P 500 and also make up the Dow. So whether the dollar can keep rising and interest rates could keep rising without a negative effect on the economy still remains to be seen. I mean, it's hard to believe on July 6th of this year, the 10-year Treasury note got down to 1.32. A lot of the technicians we've had here on the program have said that interest rates have finally, the bear market in bonds has just begun, and it began this summer when rates hit the bottom at 1.32. They rose a half a point to 1.8 on election eve, and on the day we're doing this show, they are now at 2.4%. They have risen another half a percent. So we've seen interest rates rise by over 1%. So the big unknowns here is, as interest rates rise, as they're doing now, it's going to be more expensive for the government to borrow, but it's going to be more expensive for corporations and you and I to borrow, whether we're buying a new car or you're buying a new home and financing it with a mortgage. The big unknowns right now is, let's say the president-elect gets all his fiscal stimulus. He cuts taxes, which is a high probability. He gets the spending approval with Congress for infrastructure. That's a given. And he gets the spending approval for defense spending. So that's probably going to be a second half story for 2017. However, if inflation starts to rise as a result of this and interest rates start to rise, does the Fed start getting hawkish and get into a rate raising cycle and start raising rates aggressively, as some experts are predicting, which would basically nullify a lot of the effects? I mean, if you're trying to spend money to stimulate the economy and the Fed is tightening hawkishly and raising interest rates, well, that's going to offset a lot of the things that are happening physically. Now, personally, I think the Fed, as indicated by Yellen, is going to fall behind the curve. They've already indicated that they're okay with allowing inflation to heat up for a period of time to maintain the economy. The real question is, John, we really don't know. And that's one of the big if questions for 2017. Does the Fed get hawkish as a result of fiscal policy, which is inflationary?
Yeah, but I would think they might be a bit leery. You know, the Republicans, and this was spearheaded by Dr. Ron Paul when he was still in Congress, Republicans wanting to audit the Fed. There might be a certain level of reluctance here, you must admit.
Yeah, we could actually see some reluctance here where you have, I would not be surprised as presidents. I mean, it's no secret. During the summer, this past summer, Obama had Janet Yellen to the White House. And I'm sure he was probably saying, hey, look, you know, we're coming up to election. The last thing I want you guys doing is hawkish and causing turbulence in the market and the economy. And as we've seen, the Fed has waited. So it's widely expected they'll raise in December, but they did not raise in November. They did not raise in September. So who knows? Maybe the president-elect will be using the art of the deal to deal with the Fed. But that's one of the big unknowns for next year, is what does the Fed do if we start to see inflation rise?
Yeah, it is hard to believe when you realize that we've had, what, something like $1.9 trillion wiped out in the value of bonds as a result of a 1% rise in interest rates?
Yeah, so you can imagine what would happen if the Fed got hawkish and started to raise interest rates. I mean, they were very surprised when they raised rates a quarter of a point last December, what happened in the first 6 weeks of this year. So I don't know how confident they feel they can be in raising rates, because once again, the U.S. economy now has $20 trillion of U.S. debt.
One of the other areas that these articles are tending to focus on is saying that the unemployment rate is down to 4.6%. That's a nice figure. You know, how much lower could this one get? But you also have to recognize that that number is not taking into account people who have dropped off the back end and simply can't find work. Well, when you say unemployment, the impression you get on the evening news is people are running around counting noses every week. Okay, how many we got? Everybody out of work, raise your hands, that type of thing. That's not what's going on.
No, but, you know, to Obama's credit, the unemployment rate topped out at 10% in October of 2009. The recession ended in June of 2009. And the average unemployment rate for Obama's presidency is 7.5%. He's tied with Reagan, which was close to 7.5%. The actual highest unemployment rate was actually under President Gerald Ford in the 70s. Now, if you take a look at the recent unemployment report, which was released last Friday, the November unemployment, we created 178,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate dropped to 4.6%. And this is what a lot of these, the Times article, the Post article, is saying, hey, look, you know, the president's inheriting an economy which is at full employment. And since the recession ended, the economy has added 15 million jobs since the bottom of 2010. However, as we have been pointing out on the program, the peak in job creation was in 2014. We were averaging 250,000 jobs a month. That average dropped to 225,000 jobs in 2015. And for 2016, it's dropped to 180,000 jobs. However, John, you point out something. The reason that we dropped to 4.6% is the participation rate. That means the number of people that are looking for jobs dropped to 62.7. It dropped 0.1%. 500,000 people stopped looking for work. I mean, theoretically, you could get to a 0% unemployment rate if enough people stop looking for jobs. However, a more important figure, and this is the one you were referring to as the U6 figure, which is still at 9.3%. Now, so the participation rate has been falling since January of 2007. The problem is, if you want to make an economy grow, you have to add more jobs, more workers, and productivity. And this is a trend that began well before Obama got into office. Labor force growth rates in the U.S. have moved from 3% a year down to 0.75% a year. And that, in part, John, accounts for some of the weaker economic growth that we've seen in Obama's presidency, which has been the lowest since World War II. So the trend is continuing to ratchet down. Labor force growth roughly is now about 0.5% a year, when the average has been 3%. So unless we become more productive, how are you going to grow and get an economy to grow faster when you've got a shrinking labor force?
Well, that probably segues us into the last point here, and Obamacare was a big political issue. It's been fought over ever since its inception. The mantra we're hearing is that thousands of people were able to get health care that couldn't have it before, of course, looking the other way at the thousands of people that lost health care and thousands more who had to pay much more for their health care. The real problem now is it going to be tinkered with, repealed, radically reformed, and even so, can it be kept going, looking at what's happening to Medicare and Veterans Administration services right now that have problems?
That's one of the big issues and one of the things that could possibly slow down the economy next year, because we already know, and this was a big stink before the election, some say it added to Trump's victory. We know for 2017, national average for Obamacare premiums are going up 25%. In 38 states, they're going up double digits. The highest is Arizona, where it's going up 116%. And we also know that a lot of the insurers that participate in the exchanges, like United Health and Aetna, are dropping out. So there's going to be less competition. We've seen cost escalate. I don't care if it's in Obamacare premiums themselves or in the private sector. And the problem that Obamacare is facing is there's 20 million people that are insured, but they're mainly sick people. The healthy aren't joining up on Obamacare because they're saying it's too expensive. The premiums are going up. The deductibles are so high. There have been a number of stories on the news talking to these couples that are saying, you know what? What good does it do me? I'm paying all this money and my deductible's $6,000. I never even get to use it. And there's also something that's going to hit a lot of families and also individuals, and that's the Obamacare tax. So if you don't sign up for Obamacare and you don't have insurance, if you're a single individual, next April 2017, you're going to have to come up with an extra $700, which will be the fine for not having insurance. And if you're a family of four, you'll have to come up with $2,300. So right around March and April next year, look for a slowdown in the economy, because there are going to be a lot of people in this country, single and married, that don't have insurance, have not gone on the exchange and gotten Obamacare. They're going to get hit with tax fines when they file their tax return, and that's going to be a drag on the economy. Another thing that we're seeing is there are a number of businesses that under Obamacare, if you have employees that work 30 hours or less, you don't have to cover them. So a lot of employers, one of the things that we've seen in this job market is the rise of part-time employees. And one reason is Obamacare. Part-time employment has risen since the passage of Obamacare. Because, I mean, companies, if you don't have the money to cover fully health care costs, well, what do? You keep your employees under 30 hours and you don't have to cover it. So even private sector costs have gone up. I know, John, one thing I've noticed, maybe you've noticed this, I've had to go to two doctors because my regular primary physician, it took me 3 months to schedule an annual physical. I used to be able to get in 2 weeks. You call up, you go in, get your blood drawn, get all the tests you have, and then you'd see your doctor 2 weeks later. Now it's 3 months. And so, you know, I've had to find a concierge service because you can't always get in to see the doctor unless you go to the ER, and that's a 5-hour visit.
You know, it's funny you mention that because we have a concierge doctor, and the first time I went to see him, he wants an initial interview if you're becoming a patient of his, with regular care being provided. And so we'd been sitting there talking for about 45 or 50 minutes, and I'm turning around and looking over my shoulder sort of figuratively, and I finally leaned forward and I said, "Don't you have any other patients to see?" You know? And he said, "No." He said, and he has a bustling practice, but he said, "We set aside an hour for the first time that you come in." And then he's really insistent that you get in there every 6 months for various checks. And it's a whole different thing. And he told me, he said, was it 10 years ago or something? He had just a booming practice, billing Medicare, billing insurance and whatever. And he said, "I almost had a nervous breakdown. I was running myself in circles trying to keep up with it all." And he said, "Okay, something's got to change." And he radically changed his practice. Now, how long, and this is the question that the specialty doctors are having under Obamacare, is how long are they going to be permitted to provide really good quality care, or are they just going to be forced into the herd with everybody else? Because, you know, already in Congress, they're talking about that mandatory physician taking this or that, blah, blah, blah. And it changes the whole face of things. That's a whole subject for a different day as to how we can effectively make healthcare work. But you have to recognize that this is all where we're at right now in healthcare. And what Dr. Jim is going to, if they're only going to get paid a base level of income, they go through an awful lot of stuff to become a doctor. It's not just a whole series of college studies and then post-college and then your internship and everything else. It's literally hell on wheels sometimes for people in the healthcare profession. Are they really going to go through all that if there's no return on the investment?
Well, and a lot of doctors today do not get paid fully from Medicare and from the government. So, you know, a lot of times you're seeing the rise of concierge services. You know, the other doctor that I have, he doesn't take insurance, doesn't take Medicare. And he said, "Look, I'd rather spend the money on nurses rather than 3 or 4 people in the back office trying to get paid from the government and insurance companies." So you're going to see a change here. But this is also something that the Trump administration is going to have to deal with, because left to its own, Obamacare is going to collapse. So what's the fix? And what do you tell 20 million sick people who now have insurance? What do they do? So this is going to be a big issue.
Now, I want to contrast something for you as we roll out here. This is important to keep in mind for all of our listeners as we go forward. The media were largely in President Obama's camp. This has been another issue, has been the whole how media are slanted. For years, they kept trying to maintain the fiction that they were somehow impartial and professionals and all that. That's all been blown to heck. That's not coming back anytime in the near future. But they gave President Obama a lot of passes. Now, as President-elect Trump becomes president, he's facing a lot more issues economically than they are admitting. And you can bet your bottom dollar that they will ignore that, but hold him accountable for what he hasn't been able to do, despite the saying, "See, he inherited a robust economy and look what he's done with it." That is going to be the political record. You can take that one to the bank and we'll replay this cut in 2 years and see how right I've been proven.
Well, you know, it's nobody's talking about this $20 trillion in debt. And what amazed me, I think, more than anything else, is during the election, neither candidate, neither Trump nor Clinton, mentioned it, and the media never even touched upon it. Because both candidates were telling the public, "Hey, if you elect me, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend money on this. I'm going to spend money on that." Clinton was saying, "If I'm elected, you're going to get free college. You're going to get free this, free that." Nobody in the media said, "Wait a minute, we have a $20 trillion debt. The Fed is raising interest rates. Where's the money going to come from that you're going to get to pay for all this stuff?" And it was never raised during the election. Watch the way it's raised next year, because it will take some creation. I think what you're going to do, I think you'll see Trump move in the direction of something like Build America bonds or something that doesn't raise the deficit, because I'm sure he's got economic advisors that are saying, "Look, Donald, you got $20 trillion here. You got a Fed that's raising interest rates. Interest rates have risen almost 0.75 percentage point since you were elected president, and they look like they're still going up. So that's going to play some limitation, and I suspect you're going to see some creativity coming here from his advisors. But once again, he is facing a challenged economy and a challenged federal budget as he takes office January 20th.
Okay, so here we are. We are just past the beginning of December, rapidly coming up on the half mark of December, wrapping out for the rest of the year. What are we looking for? Obviously, an interest rate hike from the Fed. And then what are we doing on the show during the holidays? Because it's always different for Financial Sense.
Let me see. Coming up next week, the Fed will meet where it's widely expected. Janet Yellen will raise interest rates 0.25 point. What's going to be interesting next week, John, is to see if they move the dot plots higher, leave them the same, or move them lower, because everybody will pay attention to that. All right, we know you were going to raise it, but what are you guys thinking about next year? So that's going to be important. And in terms of how the Fed finesses this, because, you know, they got to be watching the president-elect talking about, you know, infrastructure spending, defense spending, fiscal spending, which, by the way, the Fed has urged government to do over the last couple of years. But now the government's going to actually do it. So we have that press conference. A couple other things coming up. We are going to be watching retail season, how sales are for brick and mortar and online sales. So that'll tell us about the health of the economy and the consumer. All that's coming up. But I would say, John, the meeting next week should set the stage, and it'll be interesting to see how the markets react to this versus the way they reacted last year. Remember, after the Fed meeting last year, which was a little bit later, what happened is the market started to stall, and then January, the first week in January, the first trading day, we went down every single day for almost 6 weeks. So it'll be interesting what happens to asset markets after next Fed's meeting. But those are the key things. And then, of course, we'll be seeing some PMIs, which have strengthened here recently. I know our recession indicator, which was over 20, indicating a greater risk of recession, is now slipped back below 20 and is reversed. So it'll be interesting to see if this economic momentum that we've seen here at the end of the third quarter going into the fourth quarter, is that maintained? Economists are talking about 3% economic growth for Q4. I don't know if we're going to get that. But those are the things that we're going to be watching in the weeks ahead. But in the year end, we're going to do something special. You and I will do the week of Christmas, the year in review. And I would say the theme really should have been the year of the unexpected, probably one of the biggest political upsets in U.S. History in the last 100 years, and what we saw with the election of President-elect Donald Trump. So we're going to do a year end review, and then the last week of the year, I will have an in-depth interview with Mark Levinson, author of a book called An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. All of that is coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.